In 1 Timothy chapter 6, verses 1 and 2, if you have a Bible, I invite you to turn there with me. Also invite you to stop by our information wall following the service. If you need a Bible, there are some there for you, absolutely free. 1 Timothy 6, last week we had a special message to go along with our guest speaker, Ruth Schuler, talking about the new heart, the healing of the heart that we all need. 2 weeks ago, if you think back that far, we had just resumed our time in 1 Timothy, and we're going to pick that up again today. If you remember back that far, I probably bit off a bit much for us to chew in one sitting. In verses 17 through 25 of chapter 5, my apologies for that. If you had questions that week, you were not alone. Had some great discussions following the service. If you did have questions and you didn't get to take part in those, come and let me know, and we can try to work through some of those things. But probably was a bit ambitious in how much I bit off for us last time. I'm going to endeavor to make it up to you today. Two verses, all right? Two verses, and both, you know, on the one hand, it's less for us to make sense of, but also these verses very much are a continuation of that section. They're actually a closing bookend to the end of chapter 5, so going over them is going to give us a chance to revisit at least a few aspects of what we had done 2 weeks ago. We're going to see that Paul is talking about honor. You see he's going to give directions regarding honor, another point of application from what he had been saying, directions. We're going to look at some objections to those instructions, objections you and I are going to have, two specifically, one's in the text, one is not. And then three, motivations for those directions. Where, in light of the reservations you and I are going to have, where the resources for doing this anyways comes from. Directions, objections, motivations. You can't look down on others when you're looking up at Christ. 1 Timothy 6, 1 and 2. Let all who are under a yoke as bondservants, regard their own masters as worthy of all honor, so that the name of God and the teaching may not be reviled. Those who have believing masters must not be disrespectful on the ground that they are brothers. Rather, they must serve all the better, since those who benefit by their good service are believers and beloved, teach and encourage these things. The word of the Lord. Let all under a yoke regard their masters as worthy of all honor. If you look, many printed Bibles have the section break or the section heading not between chapters 5 and 6 like we might expect, but actually between verses 2 and 3 of chapter 6, and that's correct. Really, even it's in the middle of verse 2. That phrase at the end, teach and encourage these things, is one of those hinge phrases that Paul uses both to wrap up what he had been saying and to lead into, to introduce what's coming next. So it's a hinge phrase. The section break is not between 5 and 6, but after this. This goes with what came before. As I say, it's a continuation of that last block of chapter 5. It bookends it. So what I want to do is give you a rundown of that section, what we had covered last time. And don't worry, I'm not going to do all of the deeper connections that we were making before. Just as simple as I can, surface level instruction that Paul is giving to Timothy regarding leadership in the church, okay? So Paul was saying that elders in the church are worthy of honor. Certain ones, depending on the level of service they give, if they're called into a level of service that removes them from opportunity for pay elsewhere, they're actually worthy of the twofold sense of respect and remuneration. Right? So honor for elders in the church, that's verse 17. He gives some scriptural support for that in verse 18. And then in verse 19, he says, because the work of those elders is going to open them up to the people most likely to make false accusations in the church, if charges come, don't even entertain it unless there are at least two or three agreeing in it in the first place. That's also a scriptural principle, all right? But all that's honor for elders, honor for the ones that are leaders in the church. And in all of this ordering of relationships, he goes on to clarify, says, don't think I mean just cover up for your leaders. Don't think that if they do something wrong, I'm saying just sweep it under the rug, because actually if they are wrong, and especially if you come and correct them once and they continue in it, if they continue in doing wrong, you got to rebuke them publicly. So the rest of the elders, the rest of the church learn not to do it. That's verse 20. All of this is in the sight of God, so you better be fair. You better do it without favoritism, verse 21. And when you see the severity of what's at stake, Timothy, when you see the severity of what's at stake, that before God, if you put a man in office and you've not done your due diligence and he abuses that office, you share in what he did. You are unintentionally complicit. So vet. Take your time. Investigate a man's life and his character. Because if you put him in and you've not done your part and he misuses the role, you share in his guilt. So keep yourself pure. Right. There seems to be an implication. If you do your due diligence, and then he, after he's in office, goes off the rails, that's on him. Seems to be that kind of implication. But as far as it goes by you, keep yourself pure. Take your time. 22. He gives the caveat for what keeping yourself pure doesn't mean. Verse 23. And then he gives the general principle. People are not always what they appear to be at first. But if you wait, if you take your time, who they really are will rise to the surface. It will come out, whether bad, verse 24, or good, verse 25. And all of that is in relation to leaders in the church. Now look what he does next. Honor elders, next paragraph. Chapter 6, verses 1 and 2. Let all who are under a yoke as bondservants regard their own masters as worthy of all honor. You see, he's bookending the unit. This whole thing, 5:17 through 6:2, it's all about honor. Honoring those who are in positions of authority. He's bookending this unit on honor. Let leaders in the church be treated with honor, and let leaders in the marketplace be treated with honor. Let your boss, your supervisor, your employer be treated with that same honor as well. Leaders in the church, leaders in places of employment. This is amazing. This is astounding. Back when we covered the family in the beginning of chapter 5 back in the fall, we had said one of the truest gauges of what you actually believe is how you treat people in your own family, especially those closest to you, especially those who are weak or with special needs. What you actually believe, one of the truest gauges, is how you treat those closest to you. Today, we are seeing one of the other truest gauges about what someone actually believes is how you treat your boss. How you treat your manager. This is as practical as it gets. What people think of the gospel will in no small way be dictated by how you treat those over you in your place of employment. By how Christians treat those over them. Now, you're going to say to me, and it's fair, you're going to say, it doesn't say place of employment. It says slaves, masters. So what do we do with that? Is the Bible condoning slavery? I mean, I guess it goes two ways. Maybe this doesn't apply to me because I'm not a slave and master situation. Maybe it doesn't apply to me. But also, is the Bible condoning slavery? Does the Bible condone it? So I got to deal with this, right? Because it's a fair question. Got to mention that what the biblical authors had in mind when they use the words masters and slaves, as far as I can tell, was a situation very different from what comes to mind for us. See, we picture the American system of chattel slavery, where people were treated as property, actually worse than property. Nobody beats up their sofa just because. but people were reduced to property. It was all rooted in kidnapping. People were beaten at will, raped over and over. It was atrocious. Words can hardly capture the blight that it was and is on our national history. One piece of the puzzle, one piece, is that the Bible does regulate things that it does not endorse. The Bible does not always endorse the things that it gives rules about or regulates. All you need to think of is Moses' laws on divorce. Right? God hates divorce, Malachi chapter 3, somewhere in Malachi. God hates divorce, and yet through Moses, he gives commands regarding, if you're going to do this anyways, let's at least put some parameters on this, some limitations. So the Bible doesn't always endorse what it regulates. You think also of the New Testament author's words, instructions regarding those who are persecuted. If you are persecuted, this is how you bear up under it. This is how you endure. This is how you suffer for the glory of God. It's not endorsing persecution. It's not saying it's a bad thing, but just it's giving instruction to those who find themselves in that place. That's one piece regarding masters and slaves. But I think there's even more. You see, there were instances in the ancient world, no question, where one people would take over, would entirely subjugate another people group. Especially situations where one army conquered another entire people group. This is what happened with the Israelites under Pharaoh. The Old Testament speaks strongly against it. That did happen in the ancient world, no question. But very often the situation was something very different from that. The Hebrew system that gets called slavery, and the Greco-Roman system, the secular system even. Specifically, the slavery in the Roman Empire. All right, so it's not what we think of with property. Instead, you know what that system was like? The Roman system of slavery, in it, it was voluntary. Somebody was voluntarily a slave. If somebody fell on hard times, rather than starve, they could go to somebody with means. They could make a contract with a person of wealth and say, I will give you services in exchange for food, clothing, shelter, perhaps pay. It was something voluntary. It was better than starvation. It was temporary. It was short term. It was not perpetual. It was not lifelong for that person. It didn't go down to their kids or their grandkids. If somebody made a contract with a wealthy person, their grandkids weren't necessarily going to be slaves. And so it was voluntary. It was temporary. It was monetary. You could make money. It was often a good way of getting out of debt, of ransoming a debt. It could even be looked at as socially respectable. It was not race-based, at least. I mean, that happens sometimes, but in general, the system Paul would have had in mind, as far as I can tell, it was not race-based, it was not rooted in kidnapping, and slaves were often very well-educated. Did you know that? They have a very different reality in mind when he uses the word slaves than what comes to mind for us. There are records of rich people being educated by their slaves. It's a way different situation. I'm not trying to say that their slavery was all rosy all the time, but simply don't picture American chattel slavery in the antebellum South and then read Slaves and Masters and think that's what he's talking about. The Bible uses the words but has a different reality in mind. As far as I can tell, the situation was something much more akin to a contract for services rendered. That's a whole lot more like our employer employee relationship than what we think of with slavery. It's a whole lot more like that, even if it's not exactly like it. So when you read this, you gotta ask yourself, how do I treat my boss? How do I treat him? What do I think about him or her? What's my attitude? If you're a student, how do you think about your teacher? If you're the boss, if you were self-employed, virtually all of us are accountable to someone somewhere in life. Virtually all of us are accountable to someone somewhere. But even if not, there are implications here for you, for how we all treat people around us. At the very least, you can ask yourself, what kind of boss am I? Is it easy for people who work for me to respect me or not? Right, so there are implications for all of us. The word for honor, let them consider their masters as worthy of all honor. The word for honor is the exact same word as what he said back in 5:17. Look at your elders in the church and honor them. Do you give those in your workplace, those in supervision over you, do you give them all the same honor that you give a man of the cloth? And people give us more honor than we deserve, right? But however much you just instinctively, oh, that's a pastor, I better respect him. Is that how you look at your boss, right? This hits pretty close to home. And you say, man, you don't know my boss. You say, I don't want to do that. I don't think I can do that. You say, do you have any idea what he's like? What she's like? Do you have any idea? And the answer is, on the one hand, yeah, I do. I've had bosses. On the other hand, no, okay, I don't know your boss specifically, but I get it. I get it. Our hearts don't naturally want to do what is right. Our hearts don't want to do what they ought to do. Last week, our thoughts and our desires do this, right? Honor your master. So let's talk for a minute about some of these objections we're going to have to this. Let's talk for a minute about the objections. I'll give you two. One's in the text, one isn't. First, the one that isn't. Just thinking about this and how we would apply this. Employees, treat your employers with all honor. The first objection is, we don't feel they always deserve it. Right? I mean, some people. A friend of mine once had a boss. The boss had previously been a coworker, and out of this pool of coworkers came time for someone to be promoted, and he was the one that was selected. The rest of the group thought he had been chosen, perhaps unfairly, definitely unwisely. So at least that's how they felt. This person was brash, harsh, overconfident. He literally said at one point, as the new boss, he said, my style in disagreements is to say my position, to say the same thing over and over again, louder and louder until the other side eventually gets tired and gives up. Then I win. I mean, who does that? Much less, who says that? That was his management style. The same guy once tried to say that Michael Jordan would beat Michael Phelps in a swimming race just because Michael Jordan was the greatest athlete of all time. And he would not let it go. Never mind the fact, he's clearly wrong, right? Because Michael Jordan played this sport called basketball, and Phelps was arguably the greatest swimmer of all time. Not to mention the fact that he said this probably indicate he didn't have too many black friends because none of them would get in the pool, at least not the ones that I have, right? It was a completely ludicrous position and he would not let it go. Same guy, last story. If you know who Nick Foles is, Nick Foles, Super Bowl MVP, so world-class athlete. Foles is also 6'6", 6'6", and he played basketball in college. This guy, this manager, said he could beat Foles one-on-one in basketball just because the fact that Foles was a quarterback meant he was soft, so he'd be able to push him around. This guy's like 5'11". And again, he wouldn't let it go. So they're having this argument. He's like, I could take him. They're like, no, you couldn't. They're having this argument. Finally comes time, the manager has to go back to his office. He leaves. One of the cubicle mates says to my friend, we're on the same page. Foles would destroy him, right? Yeah. We're all on the same page. We just can't convince him. Made him look like a tool. And that was his management style in everything. Think of people like that. Honor. Honor. You mean I have to honor him? Well, our hearts don't want to do what they ought to do. And if we try to take too much latitude, if we try to go too far with saying, well, their situation of masters and slaves was different from ours, so maybe I don't really have to apply it in my situation because of what my boss is like. If we try to go too far with that, you know, the word for master literally is despot. regard your despots, your tyrants, as worthy of all honor. It's no secret, people intent on climbing the corporate ladder very often are more concerned with their own achievement, their own sense of accomplishment, than the other people around them. So they're very difficult to work for, can be. And it's no secret that companies commonly make the mistake of promoting someone just above their level of competence, right? It's working here, so we're just going to keep raising you until, whoops, it doesn't work anymore, but now you're stuck there. So you commonly have this situation of people who are driven by their own sense of achievement being always just slightly outclassed by the demands placed on them. And they take it out on the people around them. And there, right there in that situation, that moment, treat them with honor. Right. And if you think, well, I'll just fake it. I'll act polite toward them, sure, but I don't have to mean it. I don't have to like it. If you think I'll just fake it, remember, this is bookending chapter 5, verse 17 through 25. That means it's built around the same center. Everything hidden will come to light in the sight of God. Faking it's not going to get you anywhere, right? This is talking about having a deep-seated respect that's generated from within you and is not dependent on your circumstances or the person around you, but with your whole being, you look at somebody else and you regard them, you consider them as worthy of all honor. Here's the second objection. That's just the first one. Right? We feel they don't always deserve it. Here's the second objection. This one is specifically in the text. And it's a good thing because we might not even think of it if Paul didn't name it for us. He goes on to say in verse 2, those who have believing masters must not be disrespectful on the ground that they are brothers. That the master, the boss, is a fellow brother. The second objection, Paul says, what about the situation when a Christian employee has a fellow Christian as a boss or employer? And in those situations, he says, you are going to have a temptation to think, he's a fellow brother. We're equals. We're both in Christ. He's not higher than me. Why should I have to respect him? You're going to have that temptation. It's a little like the old familiarity breeds contempt idea. Know what I'm talking about? Familiarity breeds contempt. My brother, biological brother, my brother was a world-class, not quite. He was not a world-class oboe player, but he was pretty close. And I say was, not he's still alive, he doesn't play oboe anymore, all right? Oboe is one of those, it's sort of like all or nothing kind of things. He was not a world-class oboe player, but he was pretty close. He made all-state band in high school. He was the soloist for so many different festivals and concerts. When he was in high school, he played the Bugler's Holiday Trio on oboe. Now, Bugler's Holiday is written for trumpets. It has all kinds of double and triple tonguing techniques that are very challenging on a brass instrument. They're virtually impossible on a double reed instrument like the oboe. So they slowed it down a bit, but they played it. It was three oboes. One was a college music major, part of his senior recital, college music major. The other, the second, was a semi-professional oboe player who was my brother's teacher. The third was my brother in high school. Phenomenal musician. And the point of why I say all that to you today is, if I were to go up and meet somebody, if I were to meet anybody who had his kind of ability, his kind of qualifications musically, do you know how I would react? I would say, it's a pleasure to meet you. I'm so glad. Wow, what an honor to get to meet someone like you. I shared a room with him for 16 years. I saw him every day of my life. Do you think I ever said those words to him? How do you think I treated him? Would you knock it off? You have to practice now? Just give me some space? I mean, I did things to him. I said things to him that I can't tell you from up here. I saw him every day of my life. It wasn't until my late 20s, early 30s that I began to finally see and realize the incredible human being he was and begin to tell him and treat him as such. All pro musician, he's my brother. And I, for decades, made the mistake of thinking that that made him lower, not higher. When two people are in Christ, it is true. Their fundamental relationship no longer can be primarily employer-employee, one over the other. That's no longer primarily their relationship. They are now primarily, in the first place, brothers. But don't you see, Paul is saying, serve all the better. Because those who benefit by your good service are believers and fellow beloved ones. He's your brother in Christ. You should be more apt, more willing, quicker, gladder to submit to him, not less. Because anytime you submit to someone, anytime you respect someone else's leadership, that's to bless them. That's to make their life more fruitful and prosperous, to honor them. You, if you have a Christian employer, you get to do that for a fellow believer, a fellow brother. You should do it all the more readily. Not to do that is a misapplication of the truth. We're brothers, not an application of the truth. What shows how much we really believe in all this, what shows how much we have been changed by this new heart, not just knowing things, but doing things, what shows how much we really believe on this is how you treat your attitude toward how you think about your supervisor at work. Even and especially those who are fellow believers. Am I safe in saying these are things that do not come naturally to the human heart, the old one? So how do we get to where we do them? How do we get to where we want to do them? Where does that come from? Three. The directions, the objections, the motivations. Three. Part of it, the motivation to do this, part of it's just a posture thing. The more you do this, looking up, the more you do that, the more unnatural it feels to start to do this. It's a spiritual truth. I'm showing it to us physically. The more we get in the habit of looking up, the more awkward it feels to start to look down on somebody else. We do all this in the sight of Christ, in the sight of God, chapter 5, verse 21. When you're in the depths, when you realize the depths of your own situation without Christ, and you're led to look up at him, when you realize your own depths, the only way anybody else gets into your own line of sight is up here. Because you know your own sin better than theirs, so you can only see them by looking up. It's a posture thing. You're looking up, you can't look down on somebody else. You don't get to the basement by going upstairs. All right? It's a posture thing. But it's more than just posture. Look what he says at the end of verse 1. Do all this, regard them as honor, so the name of God and the teaching may not be reviled. The name of God and the teaching, what does he mean? The fact you can't look down on somebody else when you're looking up at Christ is due not just to your posture, your positioning as you look at him, it's also a function of the one you're looking at. It's a function of his likeness, his name, what we teach about him. What was he like? What did he do? Paul says, he teaches on this as clearly as anywhere in Philippians chapter 2. He uses several key words to connect these two passages together. In Philippians chapter 2, he says, he, the one you're looking at, he made himself nothing. He took on the form of a servant, a doulos, a slave. Same word. As here, made himself a slave. He says, do not look to your own interests, but in humility, consider others better than yourselves, higher than yourselves. Have this same mind in you, which was also in Christ Jesus. This looking up at others, this was his mindset. Put it in you. How did Jesus Christ rescue you? You see, Jesus Christ looked at you and Saul, you had a debt you could never repay. you owed more than you could ever scrape together. And rather, when he saw you in that, rather than stand around, rather than sit around and wait and watch and see if you could muster up enough, if you could scrape enough together, if you could collect to give some sort of payment back, rather than wait and watch to see what you did, what you would do, what did he do? He sold himself into indentured servitude. He made himself a slave to treat you better than you deserved, to give you an honor you did not deserve. The whole way through his life, he was obedient to his master, his heavenly father, and the whole way through his life, he went around and he treated people as higher than himself. He served, and he did that all the way through his life, all the way to the cross, all the way to the grave. You can't see that. You can't experience that. You can't be on the receiving end of that and then turn around and look at somebody else and say, I'm not going to honor them if they don't deserve it. I'm only going to honor them if they do deserve it. He lived and died as a slave to ransom you, to pay your debt, to give you honor. When you experience that, it'll make you start to do that for others, those around you. When you see the way he rescued you, you won't be able but to do the same for those around you, especially those in authority over you, especially fellow believers, even and especially if and when they don't deserve it. You're becoming like him. He's giving you a new heart. In Pilgrim's Progress, there's a scene. And I'm doing my best not to quote this book every week, but it's hard. It's a good book. In Pilgrim's Progress, there's a scene where two of the women, early on in their pilgrimage, two of the women are washed and given new clothes. And the clothes are so radiant, and splendor is so emanating from their persons, having been washed and clothed, that at the mere sight of one another, they are led almost to fear and trembling, as it were. And the thing is, where this happens, where they are washed and clothed, there are no mirrors. So they cannot see themselves, only the other. And as they look at the other, they are led to say back and forth, over and over, you're so beautiful. You're beautiful. You're gorgeous. You're radiant. You're resplendent. They can't see it in themselves. They only see it in one another. And there's a truth there spiritually. I'm not saying we don't have any sense of proper humble confidence in what the Lord is doing in us, but the essence of salvation is looking away from ourselves. So we don't primarily get fixed on what he's doing in us, but you look out and you see it in others. And so they're just saying to one another, you're beautiful. No, you're beautiful. No, you're beautiful. It's so over the top. It's almost cheesy. It comes across almost as superficial, almost as fake. But I'm telling you, if we could see what he's doing in the people sitting around you, in this church, all over this planet, you'd say the same thing. And it wouldn't be fake. This is what keeps us from despising others. This is what gives us the attitude we have toward others. It's a posture thing, and it's more than posture. It's what he has covered us with, the radiance we begin to see in those around us. It's what he's covered us with, and it's the way he's covered us. He made himself lower to give you an honor you never deserved. And his resurrection makes clear that's the only path. Giving honor to others, that's the only path to getting a real honor for yourself that will last. It's what he's covered us with, and it's the way he's covered us. Oh, you can't. You cannot. You cannot look down on others while you're looking up at him. May it be the case with us this week with your boss.